Good Monday morning. Hope your last day of September's off to a great start so far today. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon, and here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Got a science question for us this morning. It is time this hour for Science Files. St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker is back with us this morning, and I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, it's your turn to sound off this morning. We'll go to the phones for Manic Monday. It's our first open hour of the week. And, of course, as always, in our open hours, anything goes. Anthony LeBlanc with Schooner Sports and Entertainment joins me over the noon hour with more on his group's request from the taxpayers for that proposed sports stadium at Shannon Park. And we'll hear another Halifax History Moment with historian Leo J. DeVoe this afternoon. 10:08 right now, but this hour, it's all about science. Another hour of Science Files this morning. And joining me in the studio is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to you.
Good morning, good morning.
How are you in this fine, sunny last day of September?
Pretty good. Last day of September.
I know. Where's this year gone?
Where's the year gone? It's like blink and you miss your life. Yeah, I mean, crazy.
I know. Now we're getting into the chilly weather, and it can't be long before.
Oh, we'll have a few more days of a little bit of warmth. But, yeah, that jacket's going to be a necessary thing in the morning, pretty much,
Have you seen the TV coverage, the news coverage out of Calgary and Alberta? The snow?
Oh, I actually saw a friend who lives there tweeting, and she was pretty annoyed.
Yeah, snowing again today in Calgary, and very early. I mean, even in Calgary, Alberta standards.
But they've had some in Regina as well, I think.
And the U.S. Midwest, and they've been really hit hard, blizzard-type conditions in many parts. So.
Yeah, that's a bit unusual for September.
Yep, but we'll enjoy our fine September weather
here today. It's a beautiful blue sky, a few clouds. I mean, yeah, lovely day.
Indeed. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. If you've got a question for Dr. Rob here this morning, you can also email us a question, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a question, our Twitter handle, at The Rick Howe Show. I mentioned this last week, Dr. Rob, and I want to elaborate on it some more. It's a survey that came out last week that said, trust the Canadians' place in science may be eroding. Ipsos did a poll for the 3M company, and it found that 32% of respondents say they are skeptical about science, which is up from 25% the previous year. It also says about a third of respondents felt scientists were swayed by government or corporate agendas, and another 30% said they only believe science that aligned with their own personal beliefs. So what has happened with our faith and our trust in science and scientists?
Do you trust me, Rick?
I trust you.
You trust me as far as you can throw me out the window. Hey! No, there's actually a bit of history here. And if anyone wants to read an interesting book, there is a book by a historian of science called Natalie Oreskes called Merchants of Doubt.
Okay.
And this essentially looks at how, believe it or not, scientists have been involved in actually undermining the public trust of science. And so there's a group of important people who were essentially employed by the big tobacco lobby, and they came from science backgrounds, physics backgrounds in some cases. And what they realized in defending the tobacco lobby was that there was an immense amount of power to be had, not by sort of like trotting out lots of evidence against the other person, but creating seeds of doubt. And that's why the book is called Merchants of Doubt, actually. And so once you're sort of put people in a position of not being sure, if you don't do science, you think science is about sort of like, here's the answer, it's this, it's that, and we're done, right? Whereas what they did was to create this sense of uncertainty. And they found that people just wouldn't accept science if there was a feeling of uncertainty. And that is a technique that's used in debates all the time now, particularly over climate change.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's where it comes from. It's a technique that came out of essentially protecting the big tobacco lobby and is now used against climate change. And so what you'll see is you'll see people say, well, I'm not going to do anything about climate change until we know exactly what's going to happen, right? And that's impossible. Right. But it's used and it appeals to some people who really want certainty. And so it's deeply problematic because, as I've explained many, 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 many times on this show, science deals with both getting to some kind of answer, but putting in the uncertainty around that. And that uncertainty is really important in science. And I know that makes some people uncomfortable. You can even go back to politics, right? Go back to the George Bush, Al Gore debates, where Gore would always sort of like say, yeah, this is a difficult issue. I've got a nuanced answer on this. And we have to take into account all of these different factors. Maybe we can go in this direction. And George Bush would go, no, we're going to do this. And I know it's going to work.
Yeah.
And what do people go for?
George Bush.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. But again, though, on this whole question of climate change and the kind of the blowback we're hearing now in regards that there was apparently 500 scientists have written challenging this whole contention that the climate is in a crisis. You're starting to hear criticism directed at Greta Thunberg, the young Swedish 16-year-old who's been leading kind of this whole effort, it seems, in recent years. So we're starting to hear these seeds of doubt, as you described, and being planted now on this whole question of climate change.
Oh, I don't think they've ever gone away. I mean, it is the primary technique that's used against people with climate change. For example, the thing that will be used is, quote unquote, the science isn't settled, right?
Yeah.
Well, some of the science is settled. Like the whole point of the differential equation that you use to work out what the increase in temperature would be in a single system as you increase the carbon dioxide concentration, that's been known for decades, if not 150 years, right? That is known. The challenge, of course, in climate models is the fact that they are three-dimensional, they are very complex, they make a number of assumptions and so on, and they're operating in a regime where it's you need to put additional physics in to sort of like handle how clouds form and things like that. There's a lot of very complicated things in there. There isn't a single person who works on those models who would say they are perfect. They are not, right? But do they reproduce the previous history of the Earth's temperature within a given bound? Yes, they do. There's been many, many, many studies done on this. And so taking them and extrapolating them into the future, there's no reason to believe they aren't at least reasonably accurate. And that's the problem. If you want perfection, science doesn't deal with that. If you want perfection, go to math. Right? Because math, you can prove things, derive things, and so on, and everything you know is perfect there. Science doesn't work like that. Science always works with a theory. It explains things to a certain degree. There may be really, really good theories that just don't get anything wrong that we found so far, but a lot of them have sort of like small issues in them and so on. And so for some people, they're saying, well, you know, it doesn't explain this, so the whole thing must be wrong. No. The big picture can be just about right, whereas certain bits and pieces don't work. And we have that right now in the field that I work in, right? We understand lots and lots of stuff, but there are still some small bits and pieces that we don't actually get right. And that's the way science works. If you're looking for perfection, you ain't going to find it.
Because I got thrown this at me last week, and we were talking about the climate change and whether or not it's real or it's fabrication. Somebody pointed out the number of years back that David Suzuki warned about overpopulation and that the world was going to crash because of overpopulation. And they point out, well, it didn't crash.
Yeah. No, well.
And so they're suggesting that maybe, you know, this whole concern about the climate and, you know.
Sure. And I also heard that people go back to the 1970s when people were talking about us coming up to another ice age. But there are answers for all of those for why we get into those kind of situations. Because in the 1970s, people were focused on both the impact of aerosols, which can cool a climate, and also things like nuclear winters and so on. And then looking at the overall period of ice ages on the Earth over very long timescales. But the harsh reality is we now know from the temperature data that things are going up really very quickly, right? And that is the thing that we have to deal with. And there are all sorts of other things, like the classic things that people talk about is variations of the sun and things like that. And the total amount of radiation that comes from the sun, called total solar insolation, that's been measured by satellites up in space for at least 30 years now. And we have very good measurements of that, right? And we know how much that changes. And there's basically a bunch of papers on how much that changes the overall surface temperature within climate models as well. So a lot of those things, when you say, oh, but you do know about that. I mean, it could be a bit of an issue. And that just makes people go, oh, yeah, maybe I shouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's the real challenge. And not to mention the really long timescales involved. I mean, this is like a generational thing, although I will say the speed of change at the moment is kind of surprising, especially when you look at the changes in the sea ice coverage in the Arctic as well. So, yeah, I don't know what to say. I mean, doubt is a powerful thing. It really is. I mean, you can build a whole political platform around it.
Yeah, no question. You had to be impressed, though, with the turnout on Friday here in
absolutely,
the Metro.
Absolutely, yeah.
10,000, the estimated crowd.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not surprised. I mean, a lot of people are saying, you know, this is really making my teenager feel very unsure about their future and they're having trouble sleeping and so on. I'm like, yeah.
Australia's Prime Minister, though, in a speech to the UN just after Greta Thunberg, said that she and some of the others who are warning about the potential calamity here are causing, in his words, causing children needless anxiety.
I don't think it's needless anxiety.
Yeah, a lot of people agree. We are heading for a problem with this planet of ours and its environment. 10:17 is our time. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also reach us via email. A couple of email questions already in. We'll ask those as well. And we'll be back with more with Dr. Rob Thacker and Science Files right after this. 10:20 is our time right now. Dr. Rob Thacker is here for another edition of Science Files. And Ken is on the line. He's got a question for us this morning. Hi, Ken.
Hi, guys.
Hey,
hi, Rob, Rick. I called with you weeks ago, and I mentioned about the green jelly that the Chinese rover had found on the other side of the moon.
Oh, right. Yeah, I remember that.
And this week, so Charles Schulz was on the media, plus a few others, and they think they know what it is. It's star jelly. You could probably Google star jelly. What it is, it's when a comet or an asteroid or a space object goes by, like Pluto or Neptune, it picks up an organic substance called star jelly, which is sort of goldish reddish. And what they believe is that, and this is when the rover went around the little small crater, what they've discovered was a piece of the star jelly. Hmm. And this star jelly happens on Earth, but it only lasts a few days because when an asteroid or a meteorite or a comet hits the Earth, it lands with the rock and then it evaporates like a few days later. On the moon, of course, it's quite different and stays. So that was quite intriguing.
Yeah.
The other thing, you can talk. I'll just leave after I mention these two points. Elon Musk was all over the media this morning because of the Starship, and he's predicting it's a good possibility it'll be orbiting in March, 6 months from now, which is breathtaking that the biggest rocket ever, next to the Saturn V, of course, will be off then. Number three point, my final point, Rob, is I've never seen you before until the anniversary. You're very photogenic. You're very eloquent. What I think you should do is put together some sort of pilot for some sort of new space show. We are in a double zeitgeist right now. We got, Elon Musk and all the free enterprises, putting together all these new projects for the next few years. And number two, the other second zeitgeist is the streaming services. Disney spending $6 billion on programming next year, and Apple Plus is coming on. We're going to have six new services. They're dying for pilots. So, Rob, why don't you and Rick get together, put together a pilot, Rob and Rick and the alien, whatever, run around the universe.
All right. Appreciate
it. I think it would work.
All right. Appreciate
it. You're always coming up with great ideas. So I'm going to pass on talking about star jelly because that just makes me a little bit uneasy.
Kind of like toe jammers.
I'm a little bit skeptical, Ken, I have to be honest, but I will look up afterwards and see what's said about it. Mm. I mean, I will say we know, for example, there are red organic molecules on very cold objects. These are tholins, and they're responsible for many of the colors of Pluto as well. So, I mean, it's not like there aren't examples of organic things out there or organic chemistry out there. But anyway, in terms of Musk, well, that was one of the things I wanted to talk about this morning, actually. So why don't we do that?
The note says, standing in front of a shiny, full-scale prototype of SpaceX's Starship vehicle in South Texas, Elon Musk said Saturday night, he wants the company's gigantic next-generation rocket to fly into orbit within 6 months.
Yeah, so the funniest thing for this is that, in fact, Jim Bridenstine, NASA's top person at the moment, tweeted to Musk, I hope you're putting as much effort into developing the Crew Dragon vehicle. But anyway, so Musk is talking about sending this prototype up to 65,000 feet.
This is the one that looks like a silo, right?
It looks like the Tintin rocket.
Yeah, it really
does. It's crazy. So, they're talking about flying up to 65,000 feet within 1 or 2 months, they're saying. And so testing, the key thing they have to test, this is amazing about it, when it comes down, it's not going to come down vertically like the boosters do that we've seen with the legs come out and then it lands and everything, right? It's not going to do that. It's actually going to fall like a skydiver. Right. And they're going to use the flaps on the side that's on the nose cone and the tail to actually stabilize it the same way skydivers use their hands and arms.
Oh, really?
Really? Yeah. So they're going to have to
test
this technology out. I mean, I find it freakishly scary because you're literally in free fall as you come down. There's no kind of like power assist until the very end when it pivots onto its tail, fires the rocket and then lands. It looks absolutely freaky. There's going to be amazing footage the first time this is done, you know, and if they nail it first time, I will be absolutely amazed. But nonetheless, the key thing, and Ken was saying they're talking about being in orbit within 6 months to a year. The challenge there is actually really simple. The challenge for them there is they have to build enough engines.
To what? I mean, to what end? What's the point of this?
What is the point of what? Getting testing this out?
The point of this spaceship is this the long the range?
The point of this spaceship is a really heavy lift spaceship for getting lots of mass into orbit and then potentially going to Mars.
So perhaps building space stations.
This would have twice the thrust of one of the Apollo rockets, the Saturn V.
Wow.
Right? So they're looking at building a really, really huge rocket, which means they need a lot of engines. They need basically probably in the region of 30-odd engines for this. And the challenge they have is they're just not delivering engines fast enough. And so he was very careful. This is the thing with Elon Musk, is as annoying as he can be at times, he does actually qualify what he's saying quite often. And so in this case, he said, assuming our rate of production of engines grows exponentially, which is unlikely, I would say, then they would be able to get to orbit within that fairly short timescale because they have to build the booster to get to orbit. So I think in practice, they probably won't deliver on that, and it will probably be 18 months to 2 years or something like that. But even that timescale is pretty impressive, I think, right? Because they're literally building these rockets in a way that's completely different from what's been done before.
Methane-fueled, right? Is that normal?
No, that's a little bit unusual. It's not completely unheard of, but the point of that is you get to come up with a rocket fuel that is both energetic and is comparatively easily stored, at least compared to liquid hydrogen, which has to be kept very, very cold. Liquid hydrogen is what NASA is going with on the next generation space launch system, the SLS, and that's an engineering challenge to have that much liquid hydrogen. It's just really difficult. Whereas liquid methane, you can store it at higher temperatures, so it's less of an engineering challenge and almost as good a fuel. So it doesn't quite have all of the good things, because with liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, your exhaust is literally water, right? Whereas with methane, you get water plus carbon dioxide as well. So nonetheless, it's a really interesting sort of like engineering compromise to do with liquid methane, but it's a sensible one, I think. And so
says here that this will be delivering satellites to orbit at a lower marginal cost per launch than the current Falcon vehicles.
Yep.
But the next generation booster and spaceship could do much more, including interplanetary flights to the moon, Mars, and other destinations with up to 150 tons of cargo or crews of up to 100 people.
So the way to think about this is they're basically trying to design a multi-purpose massive lift rocket. And so they're even suggesting that they could use this around the Earth for trips around from, like, I don't know, the North America to Australia really, really quickly and things
like
that.
Oh, yeah, okay. Commercial airline kind of thing.
Yeah, but, I mean, they are a very, very long way from getting all of the regulatory approval they need to be able to do something like that. I mean, a very, very long way. So rockets simply break. I mean, that's all there is to it. You're looking at 1 in 100 level reliabilities compared to like 1 in 1,000,000 reliabilities for aircraft. I mean, they're beyond that in many cases. So I'm not so convinced that they'll do that. But in terms of building this amazing rocket that's going to be able to lift as much sort of pressurized space as the International Space Station right now in one launch, that's pretty amazing.
Well, and again, what's pretty amazing as well is how commercial companies like Elon Musk, like Virgin, and like others are jumping into this whole space race here.
Yeah, no, I mean, so doing the sort of like regular crewed launches to the space station, I mean, that I don't think is sort of like pushing the edge of the wedge too much. I mean, let's remember that NASA used to be sort of like a design shop, and everything was built by these commercial contractors as well. And now we're looking at a lot of that design shop stuff being done with inside the commercial contractor, and SpaceX is a great example of that, although they do use a lot of stuff from NASA as well.
10:29 is the time. He is Dr. Rob Thacker, and this is Science Files on a Monday morning. We're going to take a quick break right now, though. We've got a news update coming up for you. Even more with Dr. Rob. We'll be back right after the news, and the news is coming up next.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes.
Van Morrison on Science Files Monday morning, 10:34 is the time. Dr. Rob Thacker with us here in the studio. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. And if you've got a question or a comment, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also email us a question like Mark has done. Our email address, rick.howe@news957.com. And Mark is wondering, was Venus once Earth-like with water and maybe life? He says, I heard this on a CBC radio show. Was this because the sun was slightly cooler in our earlier universe and thus put Venus or even Mercury in the so-called Goldilocks zone?
I've seen a little bit about this. So the basic argument goes something along the lines of planets form and naturally have water because water is actually brought in while all of the material is condensing down to form the planet. And so there are water-bearing minerals and things like that. So when you form the planet, you're going to have, in most cases, a bit of a sort of like amount of water just sort of bubble up to the surface and so on. So the theory goes something along the lines that Venus may have been something like that. And then over a period of time, regardless of what happens to the sun, it's actually wound up losing the ocean because it basically boiled away. And then once the ocean boils away and all of the rock is exposed, then you naturally end up with processes that lead to more and more carbon dioxide being emitted. And then inevitably you wind up with the runaway greenhouse effect. As it gets hotter and hotter, you get more and more carbon dioxide until it reaches this sort of like limiting state. And
so the sun was slightly cooler earlier on in our history?
Main sequence star. I think it was something like 30% cooler when it started,
really?
Or
okay.
Something like
yeah.
that. So, but that's a very long time ago. I'll have to check on that because I can't remember.
So what is Venus today? Is just simply a gas planet, is it not?
No, it's a rocky planet.
Okay.
Right, but it's got a very, very dense atmosphere of carbon dioxide. So you're looking at something that is so dense that if you put anything in it, it literally gets crushed. So that's what happened to the Russian Venera probes that went down to the surface.
Yep.
They get crushed, and also it's incredibly hot. It's like 400 degrees on the surface. So it's really crazy, crazy hot.
So we haven't been able to successfully land any kind of...
We have success. The Russians, funnily enough, Venus is actually easy to get to because you can use the sun's gravity to get your probes there,
yep.
right? But the Russians landed a couple of landers on there. They've taken pictures from Venus's surface and so on, but they only last for about half an hour before they're literally toasted and crushed.
All right. Another email question here before we go back to the phones, and this is from Frank, who says, 8 years ago, physicists at the Max Planck Institute were able to teleport subatomic particles 143 kilometers. Yeah. Is this research and experimentation still being carried on, or is it gaining, or will we see ever, in your opinion, will we ever be able to teleport even minuscule objects in their entirety?
Okay.
And if so, your best guess, when?
Okay, so I know, again, a little bit about this. I wouldn't say I'm an expert, but I know a little bit about it. And so there is a difference. So the distinction...
We're talking just here, Star Trek
No, we're not actually talking about that. I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
So when people talk about quantum teleportation, what they're actually talking about is taking the configuration of one system on one end and putting it on the system on the other end, right?
So, but not transferring one to the
other.
Not
actually transferring the matter and just like going boink and it's showing up in the other place.
So it's a facsimile?
You're transferring the state from one system to another. And that has many, many uses, but it's not the kind of teleportation that you and I think of when we watch Star Trek.
Yeah,
of like,
yeah.
You're like,
beam me up, Scotty, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like that. So it's different. But nonetheless, it has a lot of applications from like signal transport, information transport, all of these things and so on. So that research is still going on in a lot of different places. A lot of people are very interested in this. I think it has potential applications in cryptography as well. So Nonetheless, it's not the same as true teleportation as we see in science fiction, because we don't even know how you would do that, quite frankly.
Do you think that's possible at all?
No. Because the best thing you could do is imagining doing something like what's being suggested, which is basically you have an individual or thing, for want of a better term, at one end, you scan that, get all of the information, send all of that information, and then reproduce that at the other end, so you end up with two copies. Right. The thing has always been, which one's the real one now? And so there are space shows where they do that. And so when you transport yourself to another place, you have to stay inside a chamber and wait for the information to come back and so on. But that's I don't think that's ever going to happen.
And I read somewhere where the possibility as well is that if, you know, when if you actually transport a person or teleport or whatever you want to call it, that the recreated person misses something. It's not quite complete as the original.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, there'll be quantum information loss as well within that. But
it's reaching out to science fiction, right?
That's probably not any different from getting up in the morning and having a bad day.
Well, it's true. So you have no idea, you know, when they'd be able to even transport even minuscule objects, as Frank.
But I mean, it's like I said, I mean, quantum teleportation is what you would imagine doing, where you can take one particular configuration and state and move that to another system and put it in that exact state. That's what they're talking about here.
Yeah, he writes, in 2012, the team succeeded in teleporting the quantum state of a particle of light over a separation of 143 kilometers. Yep. So, yeah. It's, I guess, you know, we'll have to really rely on science fiction.
It is something that's definitely going to have applications, and there is a lot of research being done into it, but it's not what people think it is. It's something different.
All right, back to the phones we go. Clinton's on the line. Morning, Clinton.
Good morning. Dr. Rob Thacker, you do a great job.
Thank you very much.
And,
really appreciate it.
I'm a fan of yours.
Okay.
And I guess the question I have for you in relation to when you guys started this conversation about skeptics of climate change, or human-induced climate change, which I personally believe exists and is happening. Isn't part of the problem that the spokespeople who, and this is not you, but the spokespeople that the media place the burden of talking about these issues, that in some cases they're well-meaning, but they're hypocrites in the sense that, is it fair for someone to say the government must do this and must do that and must enforce these changes when, for example, someone could go buy an electric car today for $30,000 and dramatically reduce their own carbon footprint and reduce emissions? And quite often when you have environmental conferences and things that I follow and that I generally believe in, I find it disheartening when you see significant numbers of individuals arriving at these events in their own personal private jets. It's a serious issue because commercial aircraft is far more fuel efficient than someone flying on a Lear jet.
So your question, Clinton, is...
So I guess my question is should the movement do a better job of finding spokespeople that actually do and do real action that others can follow, rather than say, you do this and I will do something else?
Lead by example. Dr. Rob?
No, I can see that. And to a certain extent, that's actually what Greta Thunberg is trying to do. But, I mean, Greta comes with a certain amount of baggage and so on, but I think a lot of that is actually there's a bit of controversy that's faked around her, right? And so, but anyway, I know what you're getting at. And in particular, people have talked about the Davos meetings and people jetting in and then talking about the environment there, and I do get that. There is a certain level of hypocrisy there, and I can understand it. But hypocrisy, I think, to a large extent, that is the world in which we live, because if you take pretty much any issue, there's always two sides, and we always tend to work towards solutions that are some sort of middle-of-the-road solution. And ultimately, there's hypocrisy within that solution because you do things that you don't want to do. And so that's an inevitable part of living to a certain extent. What we probably need is for organizations which, if you look at communities in general, I think that climate change is something that's difficult because it speaks from the global to the local. And the biggest challenge we have as human beings on this planet is we don't have a good way of navigating the global issues down to the local level where they start. It's a really hard thing to do. We talk about it in globalization, in market systems and so on. It's really difficult to deal with. And climate change is the classic example of this, to the point where the atmosphere becomes this thing. We all use it, we all share it, but we all abuse it as well. And you can wind up with this sort of like tragedy of the common situation where an individual feels no impact of doing something, but when you have billions of them doing something, then together we all actually end up feeling the impact of that. And that's a challenging thing. It's very difficult to get people to agree because of that issue, right? You can get countries, in fact, will play that game as well, like Canada. 1% emissions, why should we do anything? As long as China and America and India are out there doing way more damage than we are. And so that is the kind of issue that we have to come to terms with. So yes, to a certain extent, I would love to see some of our leaders come up with plans that show exactly what they're doing to reduce their emissions. There probably are some out there that are doing that already, I would expect.
Problem with our leaders, though, it's all become a very political game right now.
Well, so that is the thing that I am frustrated by. And so I was actually having a debate with some colleagues last night over a white paper. We're doing a big astronomy review right now. And so one of the white papers we were writing was a low carbon future for astronomy. And I was saying, my friends were saying, we don't want this to look political. And I'm saying, you don't want it to look political, but you do have a message that's important for all political parties. So rather than being nonpartisan, you should say you are bipartisan and that you will talk to all of the political parties about this. And I think that's what scientists should do. I'm not saying scientists shouldn't ever be political. I believe scientists are citizens as well. So you have a right to be political. But you should nonetheless take that information that you have and that science that you have and share it with those political parties. Now, they may not want to listen. They may think you're a cuckoo, like, I don't know, Maxime Bernier. I could tell you some real stories about Maxime Bernier
really?
On the Hill, actually, yeah, that I know, but I'd get in trouble if I did. But anyway, anyway.
Tease us.
I know. It's quite funny. But anyway, so, I mean, the Conservatives have their climate change platform, the Liberals have theirs, the NDP have theirs, the Greens obviously have theirs, right, and so on and so forth. So there is a lot of stuff that's relevant, and you should feel you should be able to speak about it as a scientist, and that's the key thing. Muzzling scientists is where things are really, really bad, right, and that's the key thing. But nonetheless, you've got to take a step back sometimes. Your personal politics, putting the information out there is the important thing for scientists.
Indeed. Well said. 10:46, Frank just replied to your question in regards to teleportation, your explanation. He says, great answer. Remember the movie The Fly? I don't know if you ever saw that movie.
I know what the movie is, but I've actually never seen it.
Oh, really? Who's the actor? Suddenly I'm having
Jeff Goldblum.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah.
A pretty bizarre movie, mind
you. Yeah.
10:46 with Dr. Rob here on Science Files Monday morning. Bob, stay there. You're coming up next. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Give us a call. We're back with more right after this. Coming up now to 10:50, just before we go back to the phones, here's the headline in a Science News Journal. It says, quote, cats may have attachment styles that mirror people's. 65% of felines form secure bonds with their owners, according to a study. I don't know. I'm calling BS on this one. As a former cat owner, I don't recall my cats ever.
Okay, but we were talking in the break about this. So I think this is fun. I think you're right to be a little bit skeptical of this because this is not quite like humans in terms of how they did the psychology of coming up with attachment theory. And it isn't a theory, obviously. So and with psychology and sciences like life science and so on, you're trying to put things into groups a lot of the time. And it can be very difficult to do that. But so attachment theory, I think it was developed in the 1950s or something like that. And basically, at a very high level, you have two forms of attachment. You have both secure and insecure attachments. And secure attachments are healthy. Right. And so that would be a situation where parent comes home, kid sees mom's home. So, hi, mom. Good. Feel good. And like, I'm secure. You're home. I feel good. I'm going to carry on doing what I want to do.
Yeah.
And so what they're saying is cats predominantly seem to be this kind of behavior. Like you'll come home, might come and rub your legs, then it'll go off and do other things, right? It's like you're home and so on. So on the other side, right, there's what's called the insecure attachments, and they come in different forms. Like secure attachments generally are sort of prescribed as being of one type, whereas insecure attachments come in multiple types. And so one of them is what's called anxious avoidant. And so then you're very dependent upon the person, and you're like, oh, I'm so glad you're home. Oh, coach me. I'm really happy. Oh, yeah, I'm not going to leave you alone. I'm just going to snuggle on your lap for the next hour and so
like
on.
Like my dog.
Like your dog, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know whether it's fair to say all dogs are like that, not, I guess. But anyway, so and then you have the ones that just don't care.
Yep.
Right? And then you have the ones that are all over the place and like it's sort of unpredictable and so on, disorganized attachment. And so so what they found doing this experiment where they literally put cat owners in a room with their cats, took them away, brought them back and sort of looked at the behavior of the cat, was that cats actually tend about 65% identify as being secure.
Really?
Right? Yeah. So the owner comes along, they're like, oh, you're back. Yeah, I acknowledge you. Okay, I feel happy. I'm going to carry on doing what I'm doing. Right? And so about 30% of them ambivalent, but a lot of them are avoidant as well, right? So, yeah. So
my cat would be sitting on the couch. I come home, hi cat. Yeah,
you know. Yeah, but yes, okay. So we talked about this. So you had said you had four cats.
Four cats at one
right?
time. Yeah.
So you may not have really had an established hierarchy with
maybe
that
so because they
cats.
All had their own company, right?
Yeah, exactly. So they were probably like, oh, it's the big guy again, whatever. Yeah.
The only time my cats ever got excited is when it was food time.
Yeah.
Then they saw a little life into them. But other than that, when the master came home,
did they mark your legs when you were feeding them? Did they rub around your legs?
Yeah, they would. Yeah. And they would meow. But outside of that, it was just the humans here. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think of our cats because we had a family cat for about 12 years when I was very young, and so. She would kind of acknowledge you when you got back, but she wouldn't come up to you or anything. She sort of like come and look, oh, yeah, it's you, and then sort of like walk off.
Yeah. Right, so. But I was once told that you can train cats to do anything a dog can do. It just takes longer time and more patience to try, but you can almost train a cat to do anything a dog can do.
Can I butt in here?
You can.
My cat plays fetch.
Her cat plays fetch.
Yeah, she's a bit of a dog cat. She is very unlike your cats, and she runs to the door when I get home from work. So
really?
She's super social.
Oh, yeah, very dependent then. Okay. Yeah. So, I always sort of laugh when they sort of joke about playing fetch with a cat. You're like, the cat looks at you and goes, go and pick it up.
Yeah. You want me to pick that up? No. Let's go to the phones here. And Bob's been patiently waiting with a question this morning. Hey, Bob.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Bob.
What's up today? Good.
Good, thanks.
Well, I had a brainwave.
Uh-oh.
Sit down.
Well, we're talking about the pollution problem, and a lot of the questions, and you have to agree with this, Rick, where's the answers? So I come up with a kind of an answer, but the doctor can answer this. 50 years ago, radiation became popular and whatever. And over the years, and Canada is one of the leaders of developing power through radiation, and it's 100% safer. Mm-hmm. Now, we've got to change things quickly. Mm-hmm. We could build power plants through radiation and at the same time develop, because there's not companies out there that can make enough windmills and everything that's cost us a lot of money. It would create jobs. Now, doctor, are we capable of doing it quickly and safely? That's
all right.
The question.
Thanks, Bob.
We talked about this last week for a little bit of time. And so I don't mind being on record as being a proponent of increasing nuclear power to a certain extent. I would like to see us look at alternatives to uranium, though. Fusion would be great if we can have that, but that's a long-term thing. That's always been 50 years away. Thorium is a possibility, but it's not the perfect thing that people have said it is. There's a number of nuclear proliferation issues with it as well. You can actually create certain isotopes and turn them into materials that could be used in a bomb as well. You have to be careful with that. But I do believe that nuclear is going to be a part of the future for the simple reason that we can build a lot of renewables, and those are great. But whatever we do, we're going to need some kind of backup power reserve power within that system to help the grid going. And I think nuclear has a role to play there. And that's where most people sort of view nuclear's role in the future. Can Canada play a part in it? Yeah, absolutely. The CANDU reactor is a really clever design. There's not a lot of debate about that. But it's a really big and expensive industry that involves a lot of heavy political lobbying as well across numerous governments too. So it's not an easy thing just to sort of say, let's go out there and do that. There's all sorts of things. And of course, the thing that people are concerned about are wastes and storage of waste, which is not an easy thing to sort out. Let's be honest about that. There are some solutions, but none of them are perfect, right? It's just going to have to be very careful, deep burying in geologically stable systems. And not everyone wants it in their backyard for obvious reasons. So it's not a perfect solution, but I think it will be part of the solution down the road.
And Nova Scotia has a policy right now no nuclear power in this province. But point of the pro next door in New Brunswick.
They have one indeed.
It's been operating now since, early 70s, I believe.
We're importing our power essentially from, from Lower Muskrat Falls and so on, once that's all working and everything. And so we're getting it from a different form of pollution, right? There you're actually building up higher water levels, you're changing land use and things like that. So there is an impact from that. And is what we're well aware of First Nations who protested against all of that as well. So it's not like these other forms of renewables have no cost. They do have a cost as well. And so we have to be aware of that.
And the biggest problem with Point Lepreau and places like that, nuclear power is the waste afterwards. And, where do you store the waste? And right now, there is
it's
no plan, right?
Yeah. It's an issue, yeah.
Another interesting hour flies right by. Dr. Rob, I appreciate you dropping by, as always, with another edition of Science Files. And have a great week.
Always a pleasure. Hopefully I can find a parking spot at SMU.
And on your way to St. Mary's. He is SMU astrophysicist Rob Thacker with us here on a Monday morning. Science Files every Monday at this time. 2 minutes now before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We've got an open hour coming up next hour, and that means anything goes. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Give us a call. We'll take your calls after the news, and it's coming up next.